Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. We're going to be talking about a character in Wisconsin history, the ambitious Dr. Abraham Van Nostrand and the Wisconsin Insane Hospital. And with that story is Tom Doherty of Madison, a writer whose short stories and nonfiction have been published in many literary journals and publications. And he's the author of The Best Specimen of a Tyrant. It's published by Spencer Hoyt. And Tom, thank you very much for coming in and talking with us today.
Well, thank you, Jim. Thanks for having me.
You have some experience with the current Mendota Mental Health Institute, which is located on the north shore of Lake Mendota in Madison.
I started out there as a student in 1972, and I was struck the first time I visited by what a beautiful setting it is. Great old oak trees, the grassy hill looking out over the city, after I was a student there for a while, I took a job there, and I learned from some aides who'd been there for many, many years that, in fact, at one time, a huge hospital had stood there for perhaps 100 years or more. It was all gone by the time I got there, and in its place were a number of practical but unexciting 50s era buildings. And it seemed to me that the hospital had not only disappeared, but any discussion of it, any memory of it had disappeared. And I was interested in trying to recover some of that history. I wasn't able to do it until after I retired many years later, when I digged into the treasures at the Historical Society and started reading, of all things, the annual reports of the hospital. It turns out that even in the 1860s, agencies were required to submit reports about their operations to the governor and the legislature. And these were fascinating reading, but obviously they were written with their audience in mind, and agencies have a way of putting things in the best light. They want to record how they're accomplishing their goals. They'll acknowledge the superintendent who wrote these things would acknowledge that there were problems, but working them out, making progress, things are going forward. What surprised me and what really fascinated me and brought me into this story was an appendix to one of the annual reports. This is the appendix from 1868. And it was hard to get into. It turned out to be virtually all transcripts of witness statements elicited during a series of hearings into an investigation into the hospital that took place in the early months of 1868. And there are a couple of things that emerged from this. One was that it was a picture of life in the hospital stripped of any public posturing. It was a life in the raw, so to speak, attendants talking about how they kept order on the unit, how they had to keep order on the unit, difficulties within the staff, difficulties with the superintendent, and that sort of thing. But also emerging were these two really strong personalities, the superintendent, Dr. Abraham Van Nostrand, who was really the object of the investigation, and his relentless accuser, Samuel Hastings, who had been the state treasurer throughout the years of the Civil War and who was known throughout the state as a crusader for any number of causes, including abolition and prohibition or the temperance movement. These two guys just emerged larger than life in a way that you don't expect from a government document.
And this was 1868.
This was in 1868.
Now, when did the hospital actually go under construction?
Initially, there was a hospital planned in the early 50s. A superintendent came from the east as kind of a representative of this group of superintendents that you mentioned in your introduction. This was called the Association of Medical Superintendents of American Institutions for the Insane, organized in 1844, and their purpose was to try and create public institutions, public hospitals across the country, because in their own relatively small private hospitals, they simply could not accommodate the demands, the need that was felt throughout the country. Most people were either neglected altogether or most insane, I should say, were neglected altogether or put in a poorhouse or in jail or in a barn. There are many ad hoc sort of solutions, none of them satisfactory, really. And these doctors believed that cures could be achieved if the right kind of hospitals were built and the right kind of conditions were met within those hospitals. And Wisconsin's first effort was an unsatisfactory one from the point of view of this this new superintendent, because it did not live up to the expectations of the superintendent's group. And this man's name was George McLean, and he was ultimately fired because he convinced the commissioners to plan for a much larger hospital than the legislature was willing to fund. Also, there was a big political upheaval in the country, or in the state. The Democrats were voted out, Republicans were voted in, and so the first effort ended with a whiff of scandal, nothing but a big hole in the ground out in that north shore of Lake Mendota. But speakers still came throughout the 50s to emphasize that if you build the right place to our standards, you can cure your insane, or most of your insane. And so toward the end of the 60s, in spite of the end of the 50s, I'm sorry, in spite of the downturn in the economy, the state did fund this enormous hospital.
What was the capacity for the hospital when it first opened?
Well, it grew in stages. There was an enormous central building. It was designed as the superintendent said it should be. Anyone coming from Illinois or Indiana who saw the hospital from a distance would know immediately what it was, because their hospitals looked the same, as did dozens of hospitals across the state. But the Wisconsin Hospital began with a central building, and then there were transverse wings and horizontal wings were added throughout that decade, achieving ultimately a length of 569 feet, which is almost two football fields end to end. When it opened, however, there was just the central building and one wing, and a lot of construction work still going on.
Was it located on the site of where Mendota Mental Health Institute is located now?
It was. You can still see some remnants. The first building you come to when you enter the grounds of Mendota is built right over where the central part of the hospital was, and you can see to the east of that that building. Administration building, you can see how level the ground is, how open it is. There are trees around that area, but none on it. That's where the east wings of the hospital stood. Mm-hmm. Let's see.
Well, let's come back to that. Tom Doherty of Madison is our guest. He is the author of The Best Specimen of a Tyrant. It's published by Spencer Hoyt, the story of Dr. Abraham Van Nostrand, a very ambitious man, and the Wisconsin Insane Hospital, of which he became the third superintendent. And as you have told us, he's going to have a set too with the state treasurer, who becomes his nemesis in years to come. If you'd like to join the hospital or join this conversation, if you have a question about Dr. Nostrand or the hospital or any of the things that we're talking about, you can give us a call in Madison at 263-1890, or you can call us toll-free at 800-642-1234. The book is nearly brand new, just came out a couple of months ago, and has been selling well in Madison, where you have it. And we'll tell people how they can also find out more about it if they were to, for instance, if they were to email you. And what is your email address?
Doherty, T-F, D-O-H-E-R-T-Y-T-F, as in Frank, dorothyf@aol.com.
Okay, dorothyf@aol.com. Let's take some phone calls. We're going to start off with Elizabeth in Poinette. Hello, Elizabeth. What's on your mind today?
Well, I was interested in hearing, and I'll hang up and listen, about Dr. Van Nordstrand, you know, what brought him to this position, and obviously the book,
yes.
The topic of the book. So hang up and listen.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Well, great question. Van Nordstrand came west from New York. He'd gone to medical school as a young man in Vermont and decided he wasn't going to make his fortune out east. He'd take his chances in newly opened Wisconsin territory. And he came out in 1847 and hung his shingle as a 22-year-old doctor in Aztalan.
And Aztalan, you might point out, was not an Indian village at that time as we think of it today.
Correct. It was a crossroads village of Yankee farmers. It connected the roads that went through it, connected Madison and Mineral Point and Milwaukee. And he had been sent in that area of the state by doctors who said they really needed some doctors out here because in particular because of the malaria that was striking down so many immigrants working the fields along the Rock River. I'll try to move along. He made the happy encounter with a doctor from the South who introduced him to quinine in large doses. And he said that the one lesson he learned as a young doctor was to prescribe quinine early and often and in large doses to the people suffering from, as he called it, all fevers malarial. So he was established primarily because of his success working with these immigrant patients, and it allowed him to do what he had hoped to do from the beginning, which is to try and make his fortune in other ways in Wisconsin through investments and so on. He was not successful in this, and he, as a young doctor and still in his 30s, he went off to war with the Wisconsin Infantry Regiment, the 4th Wisconsin, and ended up assembling and running one of the biggest hospitals that the Union Army had during the war. This was in Baton Rouge in 1863, and I think that he probably earned the grudging respect of the trustees who were desperately looking for a new superintendent because of his success running this hospital in Baton Rouge. He was not, however, a doctor who'd come up, as other superintendents had, through the hospital system, the hospitals for the insane, as they were called, in the East. He acknowledged to the trustees in his letter of application that he was a second-class guy for the job. He'd have to earn his spurs on the job, but since they were unable to attract any more qualified people from the East, he was probably the best that they'd come up with. They'd already fired three people who had come from prestigious Eastern hospitals, and the word got out among doctors there that Wisconsin was a place to avoid. So they had to turn to their own to someone in the state, and he was the guy they ultimately selected in early 1864 after the previous superintendent bailed out.
His name is Abraham Van Nordstrand, and we'll talk more about him and the Wisconsin Insane Hospital in just a moment. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're very happy to have you along with us today. Thomas Doherty of Madison is our guest, the author of The Best Specimen of a Tyrant. It's published by Spencer Hoyt. And the book is new, and it is available through Tom Doherty's email address and in various bookstores in the Madison area.
At Borders University Bookstore, the gift shop with the Historical Society Museum on the square, and at Amazon.com. And also it's available at Book World stores around the state.
Okay, and so if someone wants to get a hold of you personally, it's dorothyf@aol.com.
Dorothy T.F.
T.F.
Yeah.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I see. I just didn't read it well. Okay. And if you'd like to join the conversation with your questions, the number in Madison is 263-1890. Elsewhere, toll-free at 800-642-1234. So we've got Dr. Abraham Van Nostrand now coming to the fairly new Wisconsin Insane Hospital as the third superintendent. And in the prologue of the book, you introduce us to the Reverend Romulus Oscar Kellogg of Fort Atkinson.
The Kelloggs had come to Wisconsin about 20 years or so before, and were an ambitious Methodist family. And Romulus was a troubled man who tried a number of things in life and finally decided he was called to be a preacher. And in January of 1865, he had a nervous breakdown while he was preaching. And his brother came from Milwaukee to help his wife care for him. And ultimately, the brother went to Madison, talked to a doctor there, and decided that the place for his brother, R.O., as he was known, was the state hospital. He brought his hospital to the his brother to the hospital, and he was admitted. And on the second night he was there, R.O. was found the next morning in a strong room on the fourth floor. The window was broken. The shutters were broken. He was naked. He was bleeding, and he was dead. And so that initiated an investigation that is kind of at the heart of this book. It weaves in and out of this book. It was the first really big crisis Van Nostrand had to deal with under his reign at the new state hospital.
And it was sort of that single incident which became the unraveling of his tenure there at the hospital.
It was. It slumbered for a while. The first investigation said the hospital is fine, never been in better hands. I should say this about Van Nostrand. The first three superintendents came and went fast. They dissatisfied the trustees and the legislature in one way or another. But Van Nostrand seemed to take hold. He was what they were looking for, it seemed. While there were scandals in hospitals across the country, a sense of deep dissatisfaction in state legislatures, among family members of patients, a sense that these hospitals and the superintendents who had promoted them so avidly simply weren't living up to their expectations. And in spite of that wave that was sweeping the country, and in spite of the death of Kellogg, Van Nostrand seemed to transcend all that and to win the affection and the approval of his trustees and the legislators. But as you say, Jim, this Kellogg death, the suspicious circumstances and so on, slumbered kind of under the surface for some years and came back to haunt him when Samuel Hastings launched his investigation into the doings at the hospital.
You mentioned that the brother, Amherst Willoughby Kellogg, the Milwaukee Insurance Company executive, is with the Northwestern Mutual Insurance Company, and the Northwestern Mutual Insurance Company plays a role in this whole thing as well.
It does. A couple of the trustees of the hospital were also trustees of the insurance company, including Samuel Hastings, a man named Giles, and one or two others. There was some cross-fertilization there, and I suspect, I don't know for sure, but I suspect that Hastings ultimately became suspicious because of his contact with Amherst Kellogg, who by that time was an executive with the Northwest Insurance Company, and a kind of a fellow moral crusader like Hastings was. They would have been a lot of fellow feeling between them, and if Amherst started talking about his dissatisfactions with the hospital, unhappiness with the investigation, the outrage of his brother's death, Hastings was the guy who kind of guy who would have responded to that and decided, I'm in a position of responsibility. It's time to take a deeper look. And it was that initiative on his part that brought about these hearings.
It's a fascinating story, and you'll find it in a book that is called The Best Specimen of a Tyrant, and that phrase is explained in the book.
It is. Van Nostrand served in the South. It was a part of the war I knew very little about. This was the Department of the Gulf. Van Nostrand's regiment was the first to land at New Orleans in the spring of 1862, and they and other regiments were under General Benjamin Butler, known as Beast Butler, eventually in New Orleans. And Van Nostrand really took to this guy. Let me read how he described him. First of all, he called him a wonderful man, which was rare praise from Van Nostrand. He wrote, "He is much crossed in his eyes, dresses a little loud, sits on his horse like a tree toad on a chip, is fearfully profane when in a rage, but is the best specimen of a tyrant I ever saw. And what is very remarkable in a tyrant, he is personally brave." Well, in some respects, Van Nostrand is also describing himself. He's also impatient, a take-charge kind of guy, and personally brave. So that's where the phrase "best specimen of a tyrant" came from.
Physically, Van Nostrand, I believe when he went into war, when he went in with the 4th, the Wisconsin 4th, he weighed about 265 pounds. So he obviously was a pretty sizable physical specimen.
He was. He was. And proud of it. He was the kind of guy who didn't back down from a fight and was easily provoked. This is what we learn about him when he's with the 4th Wisconsin. You see the man who's going to take over the hospital, and you have some concerns about what impulses he's going to bring to that very stressful, challenging job.
He had no accommodation for slackers, for men who were not able to get up off the cot and go back into battle.
Exactly so, yeah. He liked people who pulled their own weight. He didn't care who they were. He wasn't a racist by any means. He had been a Democrat all his life. He didn't like extremists. He didn't like abolitionists. He thought of them as long-haired fanatics. He also didn't like plantation owners who had insisted that everybody in America should be responsible for runaway slaves. He judged people by how they behaved. He had a black servant who he over and over again in his memoirs praises to the sky because he was a very effective, efficient guy who could adapt to different circumstances in the field. And he had a black cook in one of his hospitals he called Black Kate, and he thought she was the best ever because she replaced a couple of soldier cooks who were ineffective. And so he judged people by their productivity and their willingness to take responsibility. He had no taste for crusaders. He was contemptuous of people like Hastings, who stayed home, but, as he said, were happy to send all their wives' cousins to war.
He also was a little mercenary and indeed a little crooked in his dealings in that he controlled one of the important rations for the troops.
He did. He was very effective organizing and administering this hospital and in doing surgery. To his credit, he gets a lot of his military file is full of letters from family members thanking him to the sky, from former patients saying, "I wouldn't be around back here in New York if it wasn't for you." From other doctors who had worked under him and who were considered him a friend. So he was clearly an effective physician and administrator and relentless in making sure others under him were doing their jobs correctly. But he was not able to be promoted because of a technicality. And so here he had this tremendous responsibility, but he was stuck in rank as the equivalent of a major, even as officers who would gone to war with him as lieutenants were getting eagles and stars on their shoulders. And he kind of compensated once the population of his hospital started to diminish in some shady ways. He does not mention this in his memoirs, but there are letters from a liquor dealer, a New Orleans liquor dealer, in his file, asking him to take out a liquor license in Baton Rouge for this man's son-in-law. And the liquor dealer says, there are many in your profession who have done so and who are making small fortunes. And then there's a follow-up letter saying, if you have sold out all that I sent you, tell me and I will ship some more. And if you look at the figures, he was ordering, Van Nostrand, that is, was ordering more whiskey for his hospital, which whiskey was considered to have a legitimate medical purpose then. It was mixed with quinine and other otherwise distasteful meds. But the quantity of whiskey was going up as the number of patients was going down, and it seems circumstantial but pretty apparent that he had indeed become a middleman in an operation to sell whiskey to soldiers. And if anyone knew the effects of alcohol, whiskey in particular, on soldiers, it should have been a regimental surgeon. Other regimental surgeons had absolutely banned whiskey because they saw what damage it wreaked in the ranks. He was also, Van Nostrand that is, very impatient with a certain class of patients, those who were suffering from what was called nostalgia or homesickness. This was a disease that was known to Napoleon's armies and other armies. A country boy might get so far from home and become so depressed that he takes to his bed and won't move. Van Nostrand's response, as was the response of regimental commanders and other doctors, was to kick them in the butt. And he had no patience with them. This is telling because obviously he's going to encounter some very depressed patients when he comes to the hospital in Madison. There's one other thing that should be mentioned about his tenure in Baton Rouge. It appears that he was also selling army supplies to a plantation owner, the owner of a sugar plantation named Pierce, who came by Van Nostrand's office and wined and dined him to some extent and asked for certain supplies to be delivered to him. And Van Nostrand did get, doesn't specify those supplies, but he did get permission from his superior officer to make this delivery. But when Pierce came by and slipped him what amounted to $2,000 or $3,000 in bills, Van Nostrand put it in his pocket and didn't say a word to anyone. He didn't turn it over to his commander. So whatever the material was that he transferred from Army quartermaster supplies to this man, it appears that he kept the money from it.
It certainly was worth a lot of money.
It was worth a lot of money.
Especially at that time.
He left the South. He was worth about $10,000, $11,000. He was broke when he went in the Army. He had owned a bank that he had bought from a man named Leon Caswell, the Bank of Kashkanong. He was banking that there would be no war and that the bank would remain solid, its bonds would continue to gain interest, and he'd survive this crisis that was sweeping the country well and financially secure. Instead, his bank went broke, and he went to war as essentially in hoc.
Our guest is Thomas Doherty of Madison, a writer who's the author of The Best Specimen of a Tyrant. It's published by Spencer Hoyt. It's the story of Dr. Abraham Van Nostrand, who was the third superintendent of the Wisconsin Insane Hospital, which is no longer. In its place is the current Mendota Mental Health Institute, one of I believe a series of two or three other such mental hospitals around the state.
Well, there's one at Winnebago. Mendota was the first state hospital, and about 20 years later, I believe, Winnebago went up. And now both of them are called mental health institutes and aren't the vast operations they were in years past.
Now, when he was superintendent of the Wisconsin Insane Hospital, he also had some sort of criminal dealings going on there, which you illuminate in the book.
Well, it's as if after a couple of years he decided he'd done enough for the state and for the hospital, and it was time to do something for Abraham Van Nostrand. He bought a controlling interest in a grocery store in town. The store kept its original name. There was no mention of Van Nostrand as an owner. And Dr. Van Nostrand started buying his supplies for the hospital from Mr. Van Nostrand, a storekeeper. That was one problem. Another problem was that he packed the payroll with his own relatives. His sister-in-law became, in effect, the head nurse, though she was not trained as a nurse. His father-in-law was a paid odd jobs man, though he didn't do much to earn anything. Most worrisome of all, his son Fred, troublesome young Fred, who had been booted out of Beloit College, was put on the payroll as an attendant, and he was not the kind of a person you'd want as an attendant in any hospital. He was a rough kid in his behavior towards patients. It should be mentioned also, we tend to think of judge from the way hospitals have been treated in popular culture, the novels and movies and so on, we tend to see patients as free spirits, and the hospital is this kind of robot-like, all-powerful institution that's crushing the patients. At least that's oversimplifying how it appears sometimes in the movies. In fact, it really was a constant tension, a constant battle between these teenage attendants and wards up to 15 or 18 patients, some of whom were pretty sneaky people. Some were the traditional kind of patient that you think of or that the superintendents thought of when they advocated these hospitals. But a great many of them were immigrants. They didn't speak the language. They were from Germany and Ireland and Scandinavia. Others were just bone-tired and desperate farm wives, people who'd been living in fields and on their own for a long time. Often they were brought in desperately sick, chained to a wagon bed, physically ill as well as mentally deranged. The number of and type of issues that this small staff had to deal with was overwhelming. These people never had a day off. They lived on their units. They got up at 4:30 in the morning, and they didn't go to bed until the last patient was bedded down, which was sometimes mighty late. It's no wonder that they had physical clashes sometimes with or fairly often with the patients they were responsible for.
Well, not according to Dr. Van Nostrand, who claimed that there was riding, skating, ball playing, quoits, swings, parties in the open air, picnics, boating, billiards, checkers, chess, backgammon. Sounds idyllic.
It certainly does. It sounds like a vacation at a spa in Europe or something like that. And he was not alone in promoting those kind of activities, at least on paper. The superintendent's organization had advocated this kind of activity as what it called moral treatment. In the past, of course, patients had been neglected; they'd been punished, and if they'd been medical intervention at all, it often was of this depletive sort of medicine where they were bled and tied down and so on. The superintendents had a very enlightened view about this. They wanted to deal with the person spiritually. They wanted to bring them back to reality in a constructive and non-physical way. And kindness kind of became the catchphrase. Everyone had to, in their annual reports, talk about how important kindness was. But in reality, it was a matter of kindness versus control. And every day, restraints were used. Every day, these young teenage attendants would have to take down someone by, as they said, cutting off the person's wind or choking him, boxing ears. They used strong rooms. They used cuffs and restraints of various kinds. The most draconian was called the cold bath, which in effect was a kind of waterboarding.
That's what when I read the technique, it sounded to me like waterboarding used today.
It really was, and it was used. It had a theoretical benefit Benjamin Rush had recommended it many years ago. He said you can't work with an insane person until you have their attention, and one way to get their attention was to nearly drown him to death. But in the hospital under Van Noorstrand, it was strictly punitive. It was a control measure, and though he denied it to others, clearly it was used often. And when word of that got out, it was a severe mark against the hospital, obviously.
Well, and then the book sort of winds to a conclusion with Samuel Hastings in pursuit of Dr. Van Noorstrand.
It does.
As the superintendent, and tries to get him out, and we don't want to give away everything in the book here.
If I could just read a bit. Here's Van Noorstrand is summing up his case, and we begin with this image of kindness and wonderful activities and so on. And we begin with the man, end with the man saying that the words of Dante should be posted over every superintendent's office. That is, I'm forgetting the words of Dante. All hope abandon, ye who enter here. One of the other superintendents said, being in that position was like living over a volcano. And finally, Van Noorstrand was getting his comeuppance, so to speak. But he was not alone. It was happening throughout the country, in part because the superintendents had promised so much more than the enlightened hospital they advocated could deliver.
In what year did the Wisconsin Insane Hospital cease operation?
Well, it changed its name, obviously, a number of times. I'm not sure when the old hospital actually closed. It was torn down in the 1960s, so it was standing and taking patients for over 100 years.
Oh, even as the current facility is built, why, that one is still in operation.
I believe so. Mm-hmm.
So there was an overlap there at the end.
Yeah.
Well, it's a fascinating story, one I had not heard of at all. And it was a great read, The Best Specimen of a Tyrant, The Ambitious Dr. Abraham Van Noorstrand, and the Wisconsin Insane Hospital. Thanks very much, Mr. Doherty, for coming in today. And again, you've got this book in several places in the Madison area.
Borders and University Bookstore and the gift shop at the Historical Society Museum.
And you say Amazon.com as well?
Yes, and Amazon. Yes.
And if people want to get a hold of you, it's Doherty at AOL.com.
Correct.
All right. Thanks very much for being here today. And if anyone wants a CD of the program, it's available through the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. You're asking for program 529, F as in Frank. I'm Jim Packard. Thanks to Keisha Mabra for on-air phone production. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.